Good evening. I'd invite you to open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to be looking at a few passages in Hebrews chapter 11 in just a moment. And if anybody's confused, this is the last Sunday of the month. And normally it would either be a prayer service or somebody else preaching. But since I'm going to be gone next week, they just switched the prayer service to next Sunday night, even though that's the first Sunday of the month. If any of that makes sense, just expect a prayer service, or I think it's a prayer service, right, Barry? Yeah, prayer service next Sunday night. And Pat Crow is going to be preaching in the morning while we're gone, so I wish I could hear that. I guess online I can, right? That's right. Okay, so in Hebrews chapter 11, look at starting in verse 6. And without faith, it is impossible to please him or to please God, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Some versions add, diligently seek him. Verse 6 is a scary verse to me because it says that if I'm not somebody who has faith in my heart towards God, and if I'm not living by faith, that it's an impossibility for me to ever be able to please God. The Bible is absolutely clear that we're not saved by works of our own merit, but we're saved by placing our faith or our trust or our confidence in God. And one of the questions that I have about that is, how do I know if I have faith? How do I know if I'm actually pleasing to God and putting a smile on his face, as it were? How do I know if I'm that kind of person? In Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 to 16, we get a summary snapshot of what faithful people do. In the immediate context, this is referring to Abraham, Jacob, and Sarah. But this snapshot that we get in these verses are true about faithful people of all generations. So what we can do when we look at this is it shows us, am I somebody who's pleasing to God? Notice, by the way, before we look at the text itself, the context, look how the chapter begins and look at how it ends. Hebrews 11 begins and ends in a similar way. Look at chapter 11, verse 2. It says, for by it, that's faith, the people of old received their commendation. Skip over to verse 39. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Now, when he says all these, or all these people of old, chapter 11 gives a ton of illustrations of faithful people from the Old Testament. And the chapter begins and ends by saying that all of these people listed throughout this chapter, they were commended by God. Your version might say that they were approved. Just try to think for a moment about how important approval is. Remember junior high school, work environments? Is approval important? What kinds of things do people do to get approval? They change the way that they dress. They change some of the ways that they talk. They change some of their morals to try to fit in different scenarios. In this text, who are people being approved by? It's clear from this whole chapter that all of these people are approved by God. Now, if you knew that you were approved by God, would you stop caring a little bit less what people thought about you? At the end of the day, the thing that matters the most is being approved by God and not being approved by my peers and ultimately not even being approved by people in my Christian community. And so this chapter, this text helps us understand, am I being approved by God? What we're going to do is we'll go ahead and read verses 13 to 16. And we'll see what this says about this issue. Look at Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 to 16. All these died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Now, all throughout this text, you're going to read a bunch of things that mark out faithful people. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through these verses and just point out the things that are said about faithful people that mark them out. So here's the first one. They see from afar. You look at that in verse 13. They see from afar. Your version might say that they see from a distance. Growing up, I never had to wear eyeglasses. It wasn't until we moved to Tennessee shortly after I got married that I had to start wearing glasses. I'm nearsighted, which means that I can see things close that are close up. If I'm reading a book, I don't need glasses. If I'm driving, I need to wear my glasses because I need to be able to see the signs and everything like that. I don't know if you need glasses or what exactly your eye problems are, but what the writer of Hebrews is doing when he says this is he's applying this spiritually speaking. People who are faithful have the ability to see things from a distance. They're not just focused on the immediate, in other words. Now, there's two different ways in the Bible that somebody can be short-sighted or be nearsighted. Look at the two ways that this can happen. Go over just a couple pages to 2 Peter chapter 1 really quick. In 2 Peter chapter 1, keep your finger in Hebrews because we're going to go back to that passage. But in 2 Peter chapter 1, you've got Peter reminding all of these Christians that he's writing to about various qualities that they're supposed to be growing in. If you go down to 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 9, he says, "For whoever lacks these qualities is so nearsighted that he is blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed from his former sins." Do you want to know one way that you can be spiritually nearsighted? It deals with thinking about your past. There are some times when after somebody becomes a Christian and enough time passes and they start to get cleaned up and they start to be different and they start to overcome some of the sinful habits that they had, that you can't remember far back enough where you came from and what you used to be like. And so one of the ways that the faithful people see from afar is past. What has God cleansed me of? Where have I come from in my spiritual life, and where has God brought me? So faithful people always are humble in the sense that they remember that they were sinners saved by grace. That's the first way that people who are of faith see from afar. But go back to Hebrews for a second and see the second way. You can see from afar when you think about your past sins and cleansing, but go to Hebrews chapter 12, and we see a negative example of the opposite. Look at Hebrews chapter 12, verses 15 to 17. "See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled, that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears." Here's the story of Esau. Here's a man that in the book of Genesis became very hungry in the moment, and he had extreme discomfort and pain as his stomach was grumbling and he thought he was going to die. And so what he decides to do is he can't see in a distance. And he ends up selling his birthright and he gives up all of his future blessings for a single meal. That's an example of somebody who's not seeing from afar. What does this mean for the Christian? Do you ever get some kind of momentary pain in this life? Maybe it's emotional, maybe it's physical. Do you know what waiting on the Lord means? Waiting on the Lord means that I'm not going to take things into my own hands and excuse sin and sell my eventual birthright to be with God forever in heaven by indulging in sin in the moment to try to ease some of the pain that I'm going through. I've heard people say before that out of all the people in the world who should understand patience, it should be the Christian. And the reason is because we see things from afar. We're not focused on the moment, even when we're going through pain of some sort. So that's the first thing that we see about the faithful. Look at the second one, though, in verse 13 in the text. Not only do they see things from afar, they also greeted things from afar. Your version might say that they welcomed things from afar. Now, as you're looking at these first two, you might be wondering, what's the difference between these two things? The first one they see, the second one they greet. It's interesting that the Greek word for greet there, that's the same word that Paul will use in a lot of the letters of the New Testament when he sends greetings to different Christians that are in different churches. For example, in Romans 16, and Paul sends out all of these greetings to all of these different Christians. How would Paul think about the Christians that he was separated from when he would send greetings to them? Do you think that he had a sense of joy in the moment when he thought about the good relationship that he had with them? In fact, the word for greet from afar means to welcome joyfully, even if it's at a distance. So what's the difference between these two things? Christians don't just see things from afar and grin and bear it. Have you ever met a Christian like that or been in that situation? Where you think to yourself, well, I know that I'm going to have these blessings in the future one day, and things just kind of stink right now, and I'm going to have to get used to that. This shows us that Christians also greet what we have from afar in the distance, which means that we rejoice in the hope that we have. Which means that in the moment, even if we're far from the future blessings that we have, we still have reason to have joy. When Samantha and I got engaged, we had an 11-month engagement. And it was a great time because we knew that there was a time where we were going to get married. And so even though we weren't yet married, we had joy in the relationship and the fact that we knew that we were going to be married, and it's almost been 5 years now. What this means for the Christian is this. Whatever you're going through right now, there's still something in the future that you can embrace and that you can greet and that can still give you joy in the moment, even though your circumstances might not be exactly what you want them to be. So not only do they see from afar, they greet from afar. Look at the third thing in the text. They acknowledge in verse 13, they acknowledge that they are strangers and exiles. Your version might say that they confessed that they're strangers and exiles. This is an interesting idea. When we think in the Bible about confessing Jesus as our Lord, we talked about it last Wednesday, and the idea of confessing something is not just that you speak about it, though it includes that. It means that you actually live these things out. Now, this text not saying that we confess Jesus as our Lord. It's saying that we confess Jesus, or that we confess the fact that we're strangers and exiles. When Samantha and I moved to Tennessee, we knew pretty quickly that we were strangers and exiles to everybody because of our accents. Samantha has a thicker Minnesotan accent than I do. I still had somewhat of one when I went there, and people would make fun of us for that. And the climate was different, and the roads were different, and everything was just really different. Do you know what ends up happening with people when they are strangers in a strange land? Is they want to start trying to fit in because it's uncomfortable to stick out. In fact, you'll see people that move from city to city and they actually change what their favorite sports team is depending on the city that they live in. And so what's going on in this text is that Christians or people who are of faith are not ashamed of the fact that they're exiles. They're not trying to hide it. In fact, in this text, they're acknowledging it and they're confessing it. They're actually advertising it. Try to think about this leading into 2017. How can you acknowledge and confess that you don't belong here? How would you do that? Now, some people might do that like a curmudgeon would do that and just be really angry all the time and say, I'm going to heaven, I'm going to heaven, I don't like anything around here. But what this text would help us see is that the way that you actually acknowledge this, and if you look at all throughout Hebrews chapter 11, people acknowledged it, first of all, by their actions. Abraham leaving Ur of the Chaldees. You've got Moses who's willing to forsake his future in Egypt. One of the ways that we acknowledge that we don't belong here is that we have different customs from a different nation. Have you ever met somebody from a different country? They talk different. They maybe have different family traditions. They maybe eat different kinds of food, and they just stick out. Christians stick out when we have a different view of sex, when we have a different view of lying, when we have a different view of ethics of any kind. But that's not the only way. Look at verse 14. In verse 14, one of the ways that we confess would obviously be through our speech. Do you know what's true about faithful people? Is that throughout history, people who really have faith, they speak about these things. Now, in the immediate context, it seems like they're speaking about the afterlife and they're speaking about where they're going. Just try to think about this for a moment. How often do you speak about where you're going? How often do you speak about God's things? And Jesus would tell us, other passages in the Bible would tell us, that the words that come off of our lips stem from our heart, from the recesses of our heart. Which means that if you want to know what you're really excited about and you really care about the most, you can assess that based on what you talk about. People of faith talk about God's things. They confess these things. But look at what else it says. If you keep looking at the list in verse 15, faithful people don't think about what they've left. It talks about Abraham and all of these people that had they thought about some of the things that they had left, they would have had opportunity to return to it. Now, we've already seen in this text that seeing from afar, when we contrast that or compare it with 2 Peter, it still means that we remember where we came from. So what does this mean? When we don't think about what we left, the idea is this, that we don't think about our former sins with fondness. And we don't think about it with so much care and desire to go back to it that we actually do it. Here's just a test for you. When was the last time you did that? When was the last time you thought about the sins before you were a Christian and thought to yourself, I would like to go back to that because it's comfortable, it's what was familiar to me? Faithful people don't do that. Can you think of anybody in the Bible that did that? Do you remember Lot's wife? We're told to remember Lot's wife. Where she was leaving Sodom and Gomorrah, and her heart had gotten so attached to all the sin that was going on in that city, that as she was leaving it and as the angels were bringing them out, she looked back longingly and turned into a pillar of salt. What about the Israelites? After they crossed the Red Sea and shortly thereafter they start remembering all the food that they had in Egypt, what did they forget though? They forgot all the times of slavery. Do you know what happens with Christians after they get baptized? After somebody gets baptized and they become a Christian, there's always a period of wilderness testing. When the Israelites had the baptism of Moses and crossed the Red Sea, they were tested in the wilderness. When Jesus was baptized in the Gospels, he went to the wilderness to get tested. When somebody becomes a Christian, they end up getting tested, and I think God is allowing that to happen for us to analyze ourselves and think, am I wanting to go back? I've seen this happen before when somebody becomes a convert and when they get baptized, they don't get infused with all of this knowledge of the Bible, and so they get frustrated that they are not learning as fast as they wish they could. Or maybe somebody's been around for a little bit and they're not as far along as they think they should be and they're just getting exhausted, so they just decide to give up. By the way, that's the struggle for the audience of Hebrews. These people were Jews who had become Christians, and because they were getting persecuted, they were in danger of falling away. But faithful people don't longingly look back at where they came from. Here's the next thing. The faithful people desire a better country in verse 16. Is this a hard thing for you? We live in what many people call the best nation that has ever existed. Every single one of us essentially gets to live like a king. We have all kinds of freedom that not many other nations didn't have. Would you for a moment like to go back 40 years and live in that time period? Some of you probably would, because you probably remember that and like it. But can you imagine going back to like no cell phone? Can you imagine going back to the kind of technology that they had back then? There's a lot of folks that would never want to do that. Here, the people that are told are faithful, they're always desiring a better country, which is hard because we can't imagine a better country in this nation. By the way, think about some of the faithful people in Hebrews 11. Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees, and archaeological discoveries have showed us that that city was extraordinarily advanced for its time. They had figured out how to have like air conditioning inside their houses. They had figured out how to have running water inside their houses. And here Abraham is leaving that area, and the text says that he was desiring a better country. Look at Hebrews 11, verses 24 and 25, talking about Moses. Skip down to verses 24 and 25. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. Here's Moses, and he's growing up in Pharaoh's household. He was getting groomed likely to be the next king, or the next Pharaoh. He probably could have had his own pyramid. And now this text says this man desired a better country. Can you imagine what would be better than the country that we live in? When I was in elementary school, we had an assignment, and I don't know if any of you guys ever had to do this, but the kids had to like collaborate in small groups and determine what the ideal nation in the world would be. And they got to come up with all the laws, and they got to determine everything that would be true about the nation, even the shape of the geography of it and everything like that. And after the kids initially got their jokes out of saying that there would be free candy for everybody and lame things like that, and they got to the serious discussion, you know what kids actually said? It boiled down to two things. That the perfect nation wouldn't have crime. You wouldn't have to lock your doors. And the perfect nation would have really nice infrastructure. We'd have nice roads. We wouldn't have any kinds of problems with things like that. You know how the Bible describes heaven? It's a place where righteous people will be. And metaphorically speaking, if we had houses, we would never have to lock the door. It's a place where in Revelation 21 and 22, it's described as being built with the finest gemstones and the most precious metals and everything like that. Look at Hebrews 11 verse 10, sticking in the same chapter. Hebrews 11, 10 says, for he was looking forward to a city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. Do you have a favorite architect? It's interesting when you think about architecture. There's different people that have designed some really cool structures and buildings. This place that we're going, the infrastructure is going to be perfect. And so faithful people are always desiring that better place. But look at the next thing in the text. Look at verse 16. These faithful people, according to verse 16, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Now, this doesn't mean that faithful people can completely cease doing anything that's ever shameful. That's not the idea. The idea is that when God looks at people who have faith or trust in God, that he's not ashamed to be their God. And if you were to scan chapter 11 of Hebrews, some of the names would be shocking. Noah. Now, he faithfully built the ark. But what did he do after he got out of the ark? He got drunk, and he was in his tent, and his son did something to him in the tent. We don't know what it was. And we remember a story like that, and we just get ashamed that that's there. And the text says, God's not ashamed to be the God of Noah. The text would also talk about David. David was just an all-around perfect guy, wasn't he? Sleeps with Bathsheba and murders her husband. And we look at those stories and they were indeed displeasing things to the Lord. But at the end of the day, because he was a man that lived by faith, God's not ashamed to be called the God of David. What about Samson? You go down to verse 32 and you think about Samson. And I don't know about you, but when I think about Samson, I just remember him for all of his mistakes because I'm not as merciful as God is. Because the way that God remembers Samson, even though he had all of his struggles, is God remembers that man as a man of faith. Now, none of that excuses any kind of sin. But what it does is it comforts us. Do you have anybody in your life that's ashamed to be associated with you? Maybe it's because of a past sin. Maybe it's because of a belief that you have. But the last thing I ever want to do is shame my family, for example. I don't want Asher to grow up and be ashamed that I'm his dad. But we end up making mistakes in this life. But there's one being who will never be ashamed to be called our God if we're living by faith. And those are the faithful. Now look at the last thing. We skipped this in verse 13. I've always wanted to say this in a sermon. Now seventhly. Seventhly. In verse 13, all of these people died in faith. Isn't that a sad thing? You've got all of these faithful people in Hebrews chapter 11, and they lived by faith, and they desired a better country. They greeted things from afar. They didn't think about where they left. They did all of these kinds of things, and they end up dying without ever having received all of the promises. You think about Moses, who did all of that work in the wilderness with the Israelites, and because of one mistake, he can't go into the promised land. You think about Abraham, all of that time living in tents, and he barely owns anything in the promised land. He died in faith. In other words, his last breath that he took, he was still a man that was trusting in God. Now, is there a degree to which this is true for us today? I understand that the Bible would teach that people under the new covenant are recipients of things that people in the Old Testament were longing for. So there's a sense in which we have new revelation. We've got new blessings that all these people of old never had. which, by the way, ought to make us even more faithful. But is it still true that Christians today die in faith? Here's a question for you. Has God promised grace and peace to you? Do you perfectly have peace every single day? Do you have that? Ezekiel 36 promises that God will take your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh so that you'll be careful to do everything He's ever commanded you. Have you gotten that perfectly yet? Is your heart perfectly fleshly and in the good sense, willing to do whatever God has said? We've got a lot of ways to go with that. God has promised us life, and every year we all get closer to death. When we breathe our last breath, unless Jesus returns and we happen to be alive then, all of us who are faithful will have died in faith, not having fully received everything that was promised to us too. Go down to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. This is the perfect example of this. Look at Hebrews 12, 2. It says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. When Jesus was on the cross, what was it that helped Him endure everything? It was the joy that was set before Him when He dies on the cross and He breathes His last breath. He hadn't yet received everything, but He was living by faith. Is faith a challenge for you? One of the things that we can sometimes do when it comes to faith, and we talked about this some on Wednesday, is that we understand we're saved by faith and not by works, but then we can turn around and make faith into another works-based system. You can do all of these things. If I was to give you the all of the law of Moses, that if we did it perfectly, we could be saved, all of us are doomed in this room. You can do this. All of us can do this. God has given us an attainable standard to live by faith and to thereby be pleasing to Him. If you're here tonight and you've not been living by faith, Jesus did all of this. Jesus died in faith. Jesus greeted things from afar. He welcomed things from afar. He acknowledged that He was a stranger and an exile. He didn't think about where He left all the time with heaven. He thought about getting the work done here in life. He desired a better country ultimately. He didn't shame God and He died in faith. You can do this. If there's anybody that needs encouragement and help with this, this is an opportunity to repent. This is an opportunity to come to the Lord while we stand and while we sing.